Hello, and thank you for joining me for the fifth episode in our special series of podcasts spotlighting the Arizona Institutes for Resilience and their work with individuals, businesses, and communities to manage risks associated with climate change and discover opportunities associated with solving the climate crisis. Today, we're talking about a very powerful partnership called the University Climate Change Coalition, or UC3, and how their commitment to climate action and cross-sector collaboration is leveraging relationships and expertise to accelerate local climate solutions, which is what we need, and build community resilience. I'm Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Impact Earth. From where I sit, our discussion for this next hour and the guests we are fortunate enough to be sharing this time with are of significant importance for me, for you, for all citizens of the planet, because of what the intention is for this big idea in terms of real substantive change when it comes to climate change, and a very strong intention to be nimble, to adapt, to engage, and to move the planet forward. Please join me in welcoming Neha Gupta. Neha is the program coordinator for the University Climate Change Coalition program at the University of Arizona. In this role, she focuses on advancing climate and sustainability action via collaborative projects between university and community partners, with an emphasis on building relationships and local capacity while maintaining a strong focus on equity and environmental resilience. She is also a current PhD candidate at the University of Arizona, and her research focuses on urban hydrology and water sustainability. So she knows a lot about a lot, and she is a ball of fire. So Neha, it's great to have you here. And as you know from talking to me the past few days, you are just what the doctor ordered for me right now for so many reasons, mostly because you are about hope and possibility and change. So thanks for being here.
Thank you, Gina. It's great to be here today.
So University Climate Change Coalition, try to say that four times really fast, collaborative climate action. And where I would like the discussion to go is in kind of the big picture direction, and try to have all of us leave with a sense of how big the effort is and what potential impacts it can have because of the passion and creativity and vision behind it. So that's a tall order, and I think you're up to it. So let's start with the big vision and goal of UC3. What is it? Tell us about it.
Sure. So you've heard me talk about this a little bit, but UC3 at its highest is really a network of 23 universities located all across North America. And our whole goal is to really partner each of our universities with our surrounding communities to plan, enact, help incentivize community-driven pathways to a low-carbon future, and also increase our climate resilience by building long-term networks, by building projects. And we're really hoping to provide leadership on these issues because it's critical both to our community, our economies, to our student success, both now and after they graduate.
So is it accurate to say, because, you know, you and I spoke for quite a bit before we did this show, and I shared with you that I was there when Janet Napolitano announced in San Francisco that the University of Arizona was going to become a part of UC3. So it was a big deal. Is part of this, is it part sharing information and working together with your other partners, or is it more of a focus on sharing what's going on in our community to build capacity when it comes to climate resilience, or is it both?
I would say it's both. There's a large degree of knowledge and information sharing across the universities within UC3, but we also, through our fellowship program that we've implemented at the University of Arizona, we've really taken the task to connect with our communities and to really build meaningful community partnerships and co-designing projects. We've really taken that on with gusto, I would say. So there's a bit of both.
So when you say we've taken it on with gusto, there's no doubt for anybody who knows you, that's how you do things. That's how you show up in the world, with a lot of gusto. Can you talk a little bit, let's go a little bit into the weeds about what does that look like in this local community in terms of, let's just in one engagement? Because to me, that is always the biggest challenge. How do you get people engaged, excited, keep them engaged? So can you talk about that a little bit? Because in talking to you and knowing what I know, this is different. This feels different because of what all of you intend to come out of it. So how are you doing and leading the charge for local community engagement?
I would say there are a few different intentional designs that we've built into this program. You know, we're really trying to prototype a collaborative model to really ultimately result in solutions and outcomes that increase our climate resilience. Now, this spans almost every sector of society. You know, you give me a part of society, and I can tell you, you know, there's a way that they can get involved in being a part of our collective low-carbon future. But part of that is, you know, you mentioned being nimble. And in order for us to be nimble, you know, we really need to stay flexible. We're really trying to do things and build a model that hasn't been done before. It requires a high amount of creativity and trial and error and reflection and refining. So we really try to put into place the least amount of structure needed so that things can really stay flexible and adapt. But at the same time, we want to make sure that we're really responding to community needs, to partner needs. So there's a high degree of conversation and communication that goes on before any project is now started. So I would say these are two of the big pieces, is flexibility and also a high degree of communication. And if you want to dive into, you know, this as shown through one of our projects, I'm happy to do that.
I think that would be great to give people an example of what that looks like in the implementation piece, because I think when we spoke, nimble is key. You didn't write a booklet and say, we're going to do this, this, and this, and check off goals and objectives. To me, it's a growing, breathing, living process. And that's what gave me hope and got me excited about the whole concept of UC3 and how you're implementing it here. So yeah, I would love for you to give us an example of what that looks like in practice.
Sure. You know, I'll start off with a really fun project that we did this past spring. We had two pilot semester programs. And so for our spring cohort earlier in 2021, we partnered with the Arizona Land and Water Trust to support their conservation, protection, and explore opportunities related to the Sapori Ranch, this property located in southern Arizona that has a strong history, but also a lot of potential for moving forward in terms of being a wildlife corridor, in terms of prototyping sustainable agricultural programs. And so the Arizona Land and Water Trust reached out to us and said, you know, we're trying to do this, and we're trying to understand what's going on here and what are our opportunities and how can we, you know, perhaps build excitement around, you know, this property and tell some stories about it, especially since it has such a deep history. So we partnered with them and kind of co-designed a number of projects that we actually did. Some were a little bit more on the natural sciences end, where we had a fellow who worked on doing an ecological assessment. And, you know, he actually recruited and trained University of Arizona students in doing field work. They 3D printed some of their field tools at the library.
Wow.
Which I thought that was so cool.
Me too.
Yeah, creative problem solving. So, you know, that was one of the angles. We had another student who was a hydrology student who partnered with the hydrology field course to get the field course involved in collecting measurements and, you know, providing an assessment of what's going on with the hydrology of this property and, you know, what are some of the key things that we should know. We also had a fellow who worked on digging into the deep history of the property. And, you know, she found stories and connected threads that went back to when the land was still Mexico and even further back to when, you know, it was inhabited by the Hohokam. And so to me, that was just an incredible demonstration of, you know, a multifaceted way to really engage with community partners and dig into all of these different aspects of sustainability and climate resilience, and some of which include history.
A perfect example. I mean, it's a perfect example, and it speaks volumes about the internships and the fellowships. And I would just like to go into that a little bit deeper, because one of my highlights of my journey as Mrs. Green and this whole world that we have helped create has been working with the Carson Scholars. And it's going back a little bit, but for me, knowing them, watching them, hearing them do their presentations, feeling their passion, it really worked. And when I spoke with you, you really want that. You want engagement. You want the students involved. You want real-life work experiences. And it seems to me that this program is like the poster child for that. Is that a bit of hyperbole on my part, or is that just critical to you and what you'd like to see happen? And it's happening.
I am thrilled by that assessment. You know, it's ultimately something that we hope to move towards. It's very flattering to even be described by those terms so early in our program development. But I think that's a big part of it. And, you know, you hit it right on the head, too, that we do need that excitement. We do need that kind of that headstrong, you know, approach to tackling these problems, because they are complex. They are widespread. You know, they're dispiriting. There's a lot of despair in the climate world. And, you know, I find a lot of hope in, you know, working on these solutions actively, trying to find out, you know, what things work and how do things work better. And I think, you know, tying it back to the big scale, I really see that as being a core mission of UC3 and why these institutions have really partnered in this network, because we're all moving into uncharted territory and there's a high degree of creativity, of complexity, of unintended consequences, of equity considerations associated with every piece. And so it's helpful to, you know, communicate and share lessons of what works and what doesn't work.
So on that thread, part of what the magic of this mix has to be, in my opinion, is you have to help create some degree of curiosity. And maybe that's not exactly the way I want to phrase it, but that's what I mean. You have to get people, have enough meaningful objectives that people get excited, that their interests are piqued. How are you doing that? Are you doing that? Because to me, it seems like you are. But that's the biggest challenge. You have to set the hook first. So how do you set the hook when it comes to a very big vision and making it a practical application?
That's a great question. And honestly, the answer to that is to really start small. And for us, it's to really start at the ground level. You start by listening. And what are people working on? What are people concerned about? You know, what kinds of questions are people trying to answer, especially here locally? That's really our task, is to work in a place-based way. And so a big part of this is having conversations and then understanding What are people involved with? How do all of these big pieces fit together? And then we start to understand, you know, where would, you know, UC3 and university involvement be helpful? You know, we're not just trying to jump into every process just to be a part of it, but we really want to bring value and, you know, help people achieve their objectives faster, or bring in expertise where things might be needed, or bring in, you know, student support. So it's really understanding first what our needs and work of our partners are before we start to understand where we fit in. And that all is part of designing the hook.
Yes.
By the time you get there,
yes,
the hook is there.
The hook is set. And it's been such a pleasure for me to spend time with Jim Beiser, who is a lot of the impetus and dream behind this, and hear him talk about things, and then to get to talk to you and see the implementation phase of what he wanted. He wanted the university to step outside of itself, to partner in meaningful ways, to involve local communities, to have students excited. And it's happening. I mean, I see it happening when you and I speak and when I read about what's going on. So the next part of that is another word that you used, and you have to be careful what you say to me because I am a good listener and I write it all down. You said we are trying to be actionable, and that really matters. It's not just an exercise in educational acumen and writing a great paper and the whole, I don't know what I'm searching for. Like the scholarship part of it is great. But when I talk to you and other people in the Arizona Institutes for Resilience, they're looking for actionable things. Like we have this big clock ticking in all of our ears if we're listening. And so how do you incorporate that? And why does it matter? It's not research for research's sake.
No, it certainly is not. But there is, as you mentioned, a high degree of curiosity. So there are a lot of parallels with the research process, but it's really trying to be connected to, you know, what is the useful piece, the definable chunk that we're contributing to that helps move the needle forward in a meaningful way, but it's also, you know, an interesting and complex problem or approach. It doesn't need to be a scientific question. We've also worked on a number of projects that are more centered around community engagement. And, you know, there's all kinds of questions to ask in those processes that don't necessarily satisfy a research question, but they do really provide a lot of useful information that we can use as we move forward.
Right, and then share. And one of the things I'm just curious about, so you have piqued my curiosity, for the first time, I want to be very careful with my words. In my awareness, we have a mayor that is truly committed to climate action. I'm so not wanting to say climate change. She's committed to climate action and making changes. So I got many, many times in my inbox a community climate survey. And I'm just curious as to what, if any, your piece was in that, because that's huge. It went out everywhere. I got emails from so many organizations saying, please participate in this, please participate in this. And it felt like a community effort because of how many people I heard from in my inbox. So is that one example of a highlight of action? That is action.
I would say that's certainly action, because you want to know what your community cares about as you're starting to, you know, really start to make these changes that start to ripple across all of these parts of our society, from the political to the social to the financial to our infrastructure and our utilities. You know, certainly I would think that if you know what your community cares about, it would help you make those decisions in a stronger and more supported way.
Sometimes it's so easy for me, like people have said, quite a few people honestly have said, when are you going to run for office? And it's way, way, way after hell freezes over. And with climate change, hell is not going to freeze over because it's getting hotter. But one of the reasons is because of the role I can play as an advocate, as a squeaky wheel, as a troublemaker, whatever you want to call it. But to me, this is begging all of us to be open, work together, tell everybody what our ideas and our priorities are. And that's a community piece. So when you switch over a little bit, just move the camera a little bit forward and put the lens on the part of this that's so important from what I read of like foundational skills for students, because it's a vast world. I have two interns that are just really so wanting, they just graduated, have careers in climate and resilience and sustainability. Is that just a really critical piece of the foundation of this? Does that question make sense? Because to me, you're getting students opportunities to see what they might like to do for the rest of their life.
There's certainly that aspect to it. In addition to having our students participate in projects, which are very immersive and collaborative, so they do get a strong taste of, some things that they might work on in future careers. We also do a number of training workshops along the lines of establishing foundational skills, because part of what, we've seen over the last few decades is that there are new careers constantly being invented and being added. 20 years ago, a podcaster didn't exist.
That's so true. I mean, to think that I have been doing this 14 years, early adopter, oh my goodness. Now there's a podcast a minute going up on Spotify, but mine was there a long time ago. So you're right. You're right. There's new creation of new opportunities.
Exactly.
For students, yeah.
And so we also like to think, what are some of these key skills that no matter what you're doing will benefit you? And so we do also do capacity building, especially for a cohort in terms of, building project management skills, facilitation skills, science communication. These are just a few examples, but along the lines of foundational skills, we're really taking a multi-pronged approach to that because I think it's very important.
I think it's really, really, really important too. And when you said in the beginning, like, I'm drinking the Kool-Aid because you're saying we listen. You start out by listening, and that's how I build every partnership we have with every one of our partners. What do you need? Can we be of help? How can we be of help? And then revisiting it. So I don't know if this is uncharted waters and if it's even a fair question, but I never play stump the guest. So you can say, Gina, next question. That's the joy of being on Mrs. Green's World. What have been some of the biggest challenges? You said you've had to pivot. You said you've had to be nimble. What are some of the, I don't want to call them obstacles. I don't like that word. I like challenges. We don't have any problems in Mrs. Green's World. We only have challenges. And it's a better word. Like, I'll rise to the challenge. But if it's a problem, it's a whole different word. So what have been, for you, in terms of the University Climate Change Coalition in the big picture, what are some of the even surprises for you that you said, Gina, we really had a pivot on this one, or working with this group is really hard, or whatever, getting people to make a decision? What are some of the biggest reflections you have? Because it's been in the implementation stage for a bit. So what are some of the things that might give you angst or great things you've overcome? You get to say.
Sure. So I will start off by saying, and addressing the elephant in the room, that we started this program, in a COVID year. And so we've been doing highly collaborative projects in a fairly remote and virtual setting. So that, from the onset, has kind of set the tone and the parameters of how we've been able to do things so far. But, you know, to kind of dig in a little bit deeper, I would say that there are perhaps three key things that we really encountered and had to reflect on to design our program better. The first thing was understanding what scale of a project is really best for the timing that we have with our cohort, for the different pieces that need to be pulled together. So an example of this is, you know, joining an effort that a community partner is already engaged in or is on the path to pursuing, versus designing a completely unique project from scratch in response to community needs. So in terms of designing unique projects, you really still need to have a champion for that project and right. A constellation of partners. And a lot of times you're starting things so early that there's a lot of time needed for things to kind of gel. And even though we're responding to what we've heard, there's still a high degree of, you know, uncharted and new territory. What we have found works better, honestly, and I don't want to like confine this, but that joining in on existing initiatives or working with groups that may have been already assembled, even in a looser sense, to really work into new territory, that those partnerships and those conversations have already been had, and that we're not, you know, trying to bring everyone together and say, we know you're doing a lot of things, but also, can you do this?
Right.
That we're understanding what are people doing and where can we really bring
right.
value into this? And, you know, where are these, where are the parts of the projects that are curiosity driven enough that we can really add value as UC3? The second thing is capacity. And I think this is an evergreen thing where, you know, we've learned that we are an immersive program that, you know, I've seen a lot of transformations of our fellows already who've gone through it. And part of that is making sure that our fellow has capacity, that our partners and our mentors have capacity, and that we have appropriate capacity in the program as well to support everyone. And the third thing, I kind of alluded to this actually with the first one, but, you know, we just really need to have champions on our projects that, you know, there's a strong degree of leadership involved, both from our partners, from our fellows, and ourselves involved in the program, but that it's a very active endeavor and that the flow of information is in many directions. It's not just coming from one person and going out.
Got it. So I think perfect segue, because I'm you know, I'm sitting here actively listening, processing it, and then trying to come up with the next good question, because I'm like, yeah, she's right. So, and it makes me think about when Kathy Jacobs from the University of Arizona first told me, you have to connect with Neha. You have to get to know her. You got it, blah, 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 blah. And once I'd connected, I knew why she said it, because your passion is unquestionable and your intention even stronger. So this next question, all my questions to you seem to me to have been a bit long, and this is no exception. When you're working on this, there's so much conversation now about equity and environmental resilience together, like a marriage. And you know, and I know, and many, many, many of our thousands of listeners know that climate change impacts marginalized community, which is a euphemism for poor people, people living in poor neighborhoods, people of color, of course, women, they get hit hardest, longest, hardest to get out of it. With all of these things, every single thing that has happened in our country of late, it's the poor and the marginalized that get impacted the most, the longest, and in my opinion, the most severe. How do you, Neha, or you as the leader or this group, include that in the conversation? How do you keep a strong focus on equity and environmental resilience? Because it is a problem in our community. It's a big problem.
It is. And, you know, to answer your large question,
it was a big one. Thanks for being so nice about it.
Oh, no problem. I actually have a very short answer to that. And it's that, you know, it's not this other piece. It's embedded at every part of the process.
Awesome.
At every stage, at every decision point. It's just as much a part of a process as your general project management principles. It's not really the separate equity piece. It's
that you say, we have to address that too. It has to be inherent. It has to be foundational. It has to be a part of it. And as a white woman who's very comfortable talking about the words white privilege and what that means to me, it's not a choice I made. I showed up as white privilege. Everybody who's white does. I don't even debate that with people anymore. But to make it almost seamless and inherent and woven into whatever it is you're doing, it's not always easy. Maybe it's because of my lens, but I think it's critical and I agree with you. So can you give like an example of what you mean by that? Because I get it. It clicked for me. I'm like, of course, it has to be. So it's not like a little sidebar conversation. Oh, yeah, we have to remember equity and inclusion or whatever. So what do you do to make sure all those components are embedded in your approach?
Sure. So there are a few different big pieces to our program. A big piece is our fellows themselves. Equity is strongly considered in terms of our recruitment process, in terms of the ways that we evaluate applicants. You know, we really do not just look at how people look on paper. We also ask our applicants about their commitment to equity and ask them to say a few words on it as well. There's another big part of our program is our partnerships. And that's a very big piece. You start to think about who are we partnering with and, you know, where are people that are going to be the most impacted and how can we make sure to be collecting voices and also including people in this? And I would say that, you know, we are early on in our program development and design. So we have some relationships that kind of shaped up much quicker, especially those associated more with like institutions and organizations. But we are still very much exploring and developing partnerships with community organizations, exploring relationships and inclusion of Indigenous community members in our projects. Our partnerships are another very big piece of it. And our third very big piece are our projects themselves. There's all kinds of ways to slice and dice and approach these problems. And so we have, you know, included a lot of community engagement and stakeholder engagement in the projects that we've taken on, where, you know, we've included some storytelling and narrative in the projects. We're hoping to expand that. And so there's all kinds of these different ways that, and major ways that we have to include equity, in addition to a number of, you know, small scale decisions that come up in the course of any one project.
So to me, that's one of the best answers I ever got. I love when people say, oh, Gina, that was a great question. You know, as an interviewer, you work for that. But I also want to give feedback to guests when they, like, it's like, okay, Neha, you nailed it. It is about the approach. It is about the mindset when you start. And two things that are kind of germane to the conversation, but that have given me hope lately, because that's the next question I'm going to ask you, is I saw an article in one of the big, you know, all these news feeds, who knows what I read, think. I just read environmental news feeds. And it said that a big, important body made up probably mostly of white men in power recognize the lack of women's voices in the climate change conversation at the very international leadership level. And I'll be telling you, Neha, I cracked up. I want to call my friend Diana Liverman. And I throw these names out. And for new listeners, I need to expand on a little more. Diana Liverman is a professor at the University of Arizona. She is internationally recognized for her work in climate change. She's been part of a lot of the IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. So she's a big deal in the world of science and climate change. And she said to me, like 7 or 8 years ago, we were out to dinner and she said, women's voices are underrepresented in the climate change conversation. And I said, what do you mean? And then she told me, of course, that in many countries, their voices are not, like, they do all this research and they submit their papers and the government itself is like, no, women are not going to go represent us. So there's that we have no control over. But you do, and you're aware of it. And that gave me hope to see it. And I want to call Diana and said, we were 7 years ahead of them and did a whole series on women and climate change and had like Catherine Hayhoe and Diana and some indigenous women leaders. So that's one thing. The other part is I saw an article today from Arizona Central, which is a news agency, that are going to completely change the way they report their news as it relates to people and communities of color. And it was so, like, it's one of the happiest things I've read in ages, because it feels like our work is, you know, what we're trying to do is working to some extent. They're going to stop doing mugshots when someone hasn't even been convicted, and the beat goes on. So when it comes to your work, and I am bringing it on back to what you're doing, is one of the key parts who your partners are that give you hope? Because you give me hope. And when I said at the beginning of the show, at a time when you are much needed in my life, it was for personal reasons, what's going on with my husband's health, and it's for very professional reasons, because the news out there is not good when it comes to climate change. It's not a lot of really great news and major progress, but there is hope. So what gives you hope? That's my question.
You know, I would say the easy answer for me is the fellows themselves, the students, the community members and faculty and people who are also advanced in their careers who apply to our program. We have a very open, multidisciplinary cohort. So we get to hear from all kinds of people who are very motivated to address these issues, to incorporate it in their work, to become trained to address this in their future careers, to modify the work that they are doing now to include climate. And, you know, whether you're in a more cultural side of society or if you're on the more business side of society, there are so many ways to get involved. And people often think that it's just relegated to like the sciences. And so I think definitely hearing from people who are interested in joining her program. I wish, honestly, we could just accept everybody, because it's...
I'm sure you have more people wanting to participate than you have spots. There's no doubt in my mind.
It's true. And the people that we do accept and that we do have in our cohort, I mean, they are so motivated and just really on their game. And, you know, the youth activists that I've met, you know, they're really, you know, changing things and making their voices heard in a big way. I also see a lot of adults who are really engaged and empowered by, you know, what's going on right now. And also, you know, ultimately, or unfortunately, the way that climate impacts are really coming home to roost. I mean, we just need to look at the news headlines from the last month to know what that means. But, you know, I think there's a real collective awakening across all segments of society and across the world these days. It's a front and center issue. And for the longest time, climate was seen as distant, as niche, you know.
Right.
So I really think we've kind of awoken the sleeping giant, so to speak. And I'm very optimistic. And I think part of that is, honestly, as a young person, I have to be for the transformation that we can really bring about in the next decade. I think, you know, people work well when there's a deadline and when things are more imminent. And I think that's certainly the case has been made now with how much suffering we've seen, you know, just this past summer of 2021. So a lot of that ultimately does give me hope. People are really asking tough questions and are really starting to confront that we might have to make big and potentially painful changes across society. But ultimately, you know, it's for our own societal health and well-being. So,
and survival.
Yes.
I mean, it just is. And I thank God that I'm still a young person in my soul, because I'm with you. It's like, I want to build a better future for who's going to be here long after I'm gone. And it makes my passion be ignited and, you know, the beat goes on. So it's people like you that keep me saying there's hope, there's hope, there's hope. And I have to believe it or I can't do what I do anymore. So I have two more questions. And this is, it's not a perfect segue, but I want to get them in anyway. Because you talk about words like pivot and nimble and all of those good words that matter, and I don't want to gloss over them. But what happens when you, as the leader, the visionary, the program coordinator for this very important project, when what you learn doesn't really turn into immediate or short-term realistic solutions? Is that okay with you? Is that part of the path? It's not a quick fix that you're looking for. Is that right?
I would say that's right. I would say, though, that we do approach things with a sense of urgency.
Great.
So, you know, are things not a quick fix because it's large and complex and complicated and it involves a lot of steps? Or is it just not a quick fix because we don't have the people power behind it?
Got it. Yeah, that makes perfect sense, because there are some short-term solutions. And sometimes I think about some of the things that I do and the way I'm leading my life. And, you know, like I use bar shampoo. And that sometimes I think, you know, Gina, what kind of difference do you think you're making? And then I go to the grocery store and I see the aisles filled with like 700 different kind of products, heavily plastic, lots of chemicals. And I get a smile on my face. It's like, no, that's a short-term immediate action that makes a difference. And if, you know, 17 million other people did it, it would make a real blip on the screen. So I just don't think we can ever stop telling ourselves that that short-term realistic choice you made is going to make a difference. Okay, next question. At the end of the day, after all the building and designing and implementing, what would spark joy in you in terms of accomplishments? And I don't mean like ultimately 7 or 10 years down the road. Actually, I want you to answer that however you want. What would spark joy in you in terms of what the potential and the reality of this coalition can bring about? You, Neha.
Yeah, that's a really good question.
I know it's not an easy one, but it's a good one. It's like there are things that you have such a command of the sense of what this is, as far as I'm concerned. And like I said, I was there in San Francisco and felt the excitement of major universities from around the country working together to take on this horrible monster that we're all, you know, working to quiet or change or redirect. I don't know what we're doing with this climate change monster, everything, every day. So what's puts a smile on your face?
You know, there are a number of ways I could answer that question. I think a very immediate way that is not hypothetical or and not in the future is it is incredibly rewarding to work with our fellows, to work with our students, our community members. It's that alone, and hearing the comments that we get from them, how it was very personally impactful and transformational for them, that already, I would say, brings me joy.
Yes.
On a little bit of a larger and more abstract level, you know, early on, before we dove into our conversation, you brought up that I'm a PhD candidate. And so in addition to being a researcher, I am involved with the UC3 program, or I guess one begets the other. So for me, I also have a lot of passion for seeing, you know, science and knowledge being used to inform and better society. And so I think for me, you know, a longer term dream would just be to see a more seamless discussion and bidirectional flows of information from our universities and our institutions of higher education, which collectively carry so much knowledge within them and play a major role in shaping generations, to see them partner more seamlessly, to share information more seamlessly with our decision makers, with our policy makers, with our community organizations. But at the same time, you know, we don't just have information as part of our resource in a university. We have people. We have, you know, trainings and things that we can develop new. So there's a lot of creativity that also exists in universities. There's a lot of that, you know, unbridled sense of like mission and purpose, especially amongst our students. So I think I would just like to see all of these different facets that, you know, really bring me joy as it is, the, you know, pursuing knowledge and just the all these different facets and really seeing that connect more with all these different parts of society to, you know, we have so much knowledge. We should use that to move better in a smarter and more responsible way.
Well, you get a gold star for that answer, kiddo. That is really, really an important answer because it's kind of like the Eckhart Tolle philosophy of what's happening now. And what's happening now is that fellows are having great experiences. They're learning, they're growing, they're getting their passion ignited. Things are being shared. You're working with local community organizations. It's all happening now. There isn't an end game. There's a continuing process where wonderful things can continue to unfold and you can reset and go forth and conquer. So the last part of this is there anything else you'd like to share or like me or our listeners to know that I didn't cover and that you're going to get off and say, oh gosh, I wish Gina had asked me that. Is there anything that pops up for you?
You know, I can't think of any things off the top of my head that pop up.
Well, that makes me happy as the person that prepped for the show, that I didn't miss a big elephant in the middle of the room. And I'm glad you brought that up because so much of this has been accomplished in a COVID world. And we the Mrs. Greensworld team got to accomplish great things with our training programs, and I was dreading it because I didn't want to be a Zoom trainer. I'm an in-person kind of person. But it worked, and I just got out of my head that it mattered and showed up as fully present. So you're doing things when it maybe matters even a little bit more, because we certainly need more hope. So my last words are pretty simple and to the point, and will give you a little chuckle. The world needs more Nehas. That's one of my solutions. We need your passion and your leadership and your strong intentions. And as citizens of the planet, we need to learn more about and support collaborative climate action, because we are at a pivotal point in history. We can't say that enough. My son-in-law is a firefighter in California. And if you want to talk about the impact on a family, it's right there front and center. And they just extended him for a month. Instead of ending in October, it's November, and it'll probably be December because the fires keep coming. And I just want all of us to remember that every action we take matters. Every change we make in our personal and professional lives matter. We are way past the all hands on deck point. We're there. It's like we have to have all hands on deck now. And it's my sincerest hope that learning about things like UC3 and the important work that inspires all of you, our listeners, to take inventory, take a deeper look, do a deeper dive into what kind of carbon footprint you are leaving through your actions each and every day. I'm doing it. I'm taking inventory, and I'm trying to use the first R as refuse. And that's pulling in the right direction, in my opinion. So, Ms. Neha Gupta, thank you for your commitment to our planet and for working through our technical difficulties earlier and for showing up in my world. And my final thanks is always to you, our listeners, because without you, there would be no us. And thank you for being a part of my world.
Thank you, Gina. It was really lovely to talk to you today. And I also just want to take a quick moment to thank all of our partners and supporters and our fellows for everything that they're doing, because they're a big piece of this as well.
Let's end on that wonderful note. Thanks, Neha. Can't wait to see you in person.
Sounds good.